Parkcast, the UK's original theme park podcast.
Hello and welcome back to Parkcast. We are in episode 3 of lockdown edition. Alex is here, of course.
Hello.
And by the wonders of technology, we've all only got an American on the podcast. Hi, Mark.
Good morning or good afternoon, I should say.
Mark Rosenvig, I've probably said that wrong. My GCSE German has let me down once again.
You're close.
Yes, he is joining us, an enthusiast from over the pond, with lots of background in theme parks and amusement parks. So we're going to be chatting to Mark throughout this podcast. First of all, though, I just want to touch on our last episode. Obviously, Alex, you were counting down your top 10. And we're all, you know, waiting with bated breath to find out what number one was.
Yes.
And it was Steel Vengeance.
It was indeed Steel Vengeance at Cedar Point. Yes, it was. And what a ride that
Which,
is.
I should have been riding like now. Like right now, I should have been there.
Right now, unfortunately, you're in the confines of your own living space. But it's you're going to get there one day, Becca, I promise. We say that every week, but
honestly,
I feel like...
I know.
The reality is you will get to Cedar Point at some point and be able to ride what is arguably the greatest coaster I've ever been on. And I'm sure Mark will have a very different opinion on what my number one coaster is. But, I mean, just to discuss with you about Steel Vengeance, I mean, it's an RMC. It's got 5,700 feet of track. It's got a 200-foot drop. And my goodness, that ride does not disappoint. It has 37 seconds of pure airtime. It's truly a sensational coaster. It towers over Cedar Point, of course. It's a hybrid coaster, and you know, I've never ridden anything quite like it. My first ride wasn't the best ride I've ever done. It certainly is a lot slower in the start of the daytime, but as it picks up towards nightfall, I've got to say it's quite a sensational coaster. And actually, whilst we're talking about favourite coasters, I feel like it's a great time to ask Mark, have you got a favourite coaster out there, Mark?
Yeah, you know, it's a hard thing, you know, given... I'm 44 right now, and I've more or less been a fan of the industry since the late 70s, early 80s. But strangely enough, I was afraid of roller coasters until two girls peer pressured me onto the Comet at Hershey Park during a school trip. And it was one of those things, I had no way of backing out of it. If I was with my family, I'd say, no, I'm going to go get a soda or get a hot dog or something and just sit on the bench while my sister, who's 4 years younger than me, was riding the Super Duper Looper and the Trailblazer and the Comet, and I was the one sitting on the side. But after that first ride, I think we can all remember our first big coaster, because we're all a little trepidatious or scared or nervous, and you come off that saying, wow, that was amazing. I want to go and try all these other rides. It's hard really for me to narrow down to one ride, but I always default to one ride. And that is the Phoenix at Knoebels. There is no roller coaster. It basically, if you look at the dictionary and the definition, the word roller coaster or the two words together describing the entity roller coaster is there. There is no finer example of a roller coaster operating, standing but not operating, defunct than the Phoenix. And what it represented for the amusement park industry during a downturn in the building and design of wooden coasters, you guys probably don't remember this because you weren't existing yet, but the early to mid 80s, there really weren't a lot of wooden roller coasters being built. You had the Grizzly at King's Dominion, which was in 1982, the Cyclone at Riverside Park, that's now Six Flags New England, in 1983, and we kind of had a gap there. 1985, when this ride opened, La Ronde Amusement Park in Montreal was building the Monster, which is their big dual track racing coaster. But there were, it's not like today where we, most years we have 5 to 10 wooden coasters opening worldwide. So the team at Knoebels went to San Antonio, Texas, and looked at what they called the sleeping giant. It was the Rocket at Playland Park, several years earlier. This was way before Fiesta Texas or SeaWorld were in existence. So San Antonio was without an amusement park, and this ride was sitting there, and it was built with such good lumber. It was in such good shape that they took the chance to take it down, move it, and re-erect it in Elysburg, Pennsylvania. And from the day it opened in June of 1985, it has been highly regarded. And it's been regarded by, you know, it opened up a whole new opportunity stream, essentially, because we've had several wooden coasters in the U.S. that moved after that ride opened, like the Wild One at Six Flags America. That moved down from Massachusetts. You have the Arkansas Twister at Magic Springs moved from Florida over there. Even Frontier City, they have the ride called the Wildcat in Oklahoma City. That moved from a park in Kansas City. So the whole Renaissance movement of moving wooden coasters, which most experts, I say experts with quotes, said was an impossible task, either physically or financially, was proven wrong. So, sorry, I just ran off of like 30,000 words there. But
I mean, it was an incredible ride. And, you know, one key thing is about that coaster. If you look at it in the statistics of other roller coasters, it's not the biggest, it's not the baddest, it's not the most, you know, top speeding roller coaster in the world. It's not got the steepest drop. But what it delivers is a complete package. And as you mentioned, it's the history and the heritage that goes with that ride as well, which makes it so outstanding. I don't know what your thoughts are, Beck. Have you seen much about Phoenix?
Yeah, well, I mean, I talked about this on the last podcast, weirdly. So the documentary that got me into all of this, Coaster Mania, they featured it quite heavily in that as well. And they talked about moving it. And obviously, in this country, we have a couple of roller coaster clubs. And I know that Andy Hine, who runs the Roller Coaster Club of Great Britain, it's his number one coaster. So it's not one, obviously, I've not been to America for a long time, so it's not one that I've ever ridden, but I do kind of know of its legend. And it's painted green, isn't it? Which is really unusual. You just don't tend to get woody sort of, they're white or brown, that's it.
It's also the manner in how it's operated. It's so efficient. It's so simple to operate. It's just the old school Philadelphia toboggan coaster trains with the drop-down buzz bars that basically lock in one position. Today, I take nothing away, Alex. If I was going to name a number one steel coaster, I'd probably go with Steel Vengeance. But these rides with the class 5 restraints needing to meet, you know, ride code as that has evolved over the years for uplift force and other forces and design, they've become, you know, I'm not going to say a hassle, but it's a lot more of an ordeal to board. And then in the case of Steel Vengeance, are you holding a loose article? Is that loose article in your pouch, the zipper pouch below you? Have, you know, you've gone through a metal detector to get on a roller coaster. When you ride the Phoenix, it's just get in line, hand over your tickets or show your hand stamp, go up to the platform, get in your seat, and you go. And it's a simple, it's a very basic double out and back figure eight layout. The park's done they have their own lumber yard, their own lumber company, so they've done a fantastic job maintaining the ride. It runs as well, if not better today, than it did in 1985, and that says a lot.
And one of the most amazing things about when I rode Phoenix was, I remember, and I think it's actually in the video that Sean Thiem filmed for Theme Park Worldwide, the guy in the row in front of us was a keen Phoenix rider and was actually pretty much hovering out of his seat with his arms in the air standing in the train, because there isn't really that kind of extra protection that you have, as you mentioned, on these more modern rides to kind of restrain you. It was very, you've got that freedom and that feeling of you're able to stand up and move your body, and it's incredible. But it really does show the difference in how the industry of coaster train design certainly has evolved throughout the times. And, you know, I think Phoenix is an example of a classic coaster that, as long as it's maintained as well as it is currently, I can't see isn't going to be here for when my great-grandchildren want to ride roller coasters one day, because it's something that the park have cemented as part of their legacy, and it's really rare to see such a historic coaster still operating the way it did since day one.
And I'll say one last thing about Phoenix, and this is a general observation of mine. I have a lot of admiration in general for rides that draw multiple demographics, that can satisfy multiple demographics, not just, oh, I'm going to ride this just because it's a roller coaster, but Phoenix draws teenagers for thrills, the airtime, the speed. It draws the parents and grandparents for the nostalgia factor, the scent of the grease on the lift chain, the sound, the scent, you know, everything. It pulls the package together, but it also has just a 42-inch minimum height requirement, which is, to me, it's amazing, because a 3 or 4 year old child can ride that. And a lot of first big coaster, you know, rides have been the Phoenix for a lot of people that visit the park, because the park draws a, you know, it pulls from several hours away, but it's also a locals park and it draws a lot of families. So it's easy to design a King de Ka or a Steel Vengeance that's obviously tailored for that 10-year-old to 25-year-old thrill-seeking demographic, because you're doing it. It's extreme. But to design a ride, and remember, this is designed in the late 40s. It opened at Playland Park in 1947, I believe. So it's amazing that here we are so many years later and it's still performing.
I agree. And Mark, obviously you're somebody who's an expert in the industry and has seen a lot of the evolution in the US parks, but also internationally. You've visited many parks abroad, especially here in the UK. I feel like you've covered pretty much every UK park that's named at the top of the tier list for most coaster enthusiasts. Could you talk about some of the places that you've visited and what you've seen throughout your time in the industry?
Sure. Well, obviously, living in the U.S., especially from the 1980s, 90s, 2000s, let's say, I never lost sight of how lucky I was to have the collection of parks and coasters, because during that time, there's no doubt that the U.S. was head and shoulders ahead of the rest of the world. That's changed over the last 10 to 15 years with the development of parks in Asia and really in Europe. I mean, the European parks have ramped up their coaster installations, because a lot of parks there were, you know, they'd have two, three, or four major coasters, and that would be it. Here, as you know from your trip last year, Alex, we have a park with 12 coasters is almost average, whereas a park with 12 coasters in the UK, you have one, it's Blackpool, you know, or 11 coasters. So it's an interesting, I like the travel aspect and seeing. I'm a big food person, I'm a big culture person, and given my passion, or my, as my father would say, useless knowledge base of amusement parks, I love applying that and going to a park and observing the differences. And that could be how a park is operated. That could be what a park offers. You go to parks in the US, and I think you saw this, and a lot of it is kind of the same product in a different setting. So you're going in, you're racing around, coaster. There are very few parks, I think, in the U.S. that are purely theme park. You know, the Disney, Universal, Silver Dollar City, Dollywood, the immersive theme parks. I find that Europe has more of that. And I find that it likely goes back to the public looks for that. That's part of in the culture. It's a cultural thing for a park visit. I also find interesting in the U.K., the parks are set up as, I know they're called leisure parks, and that's not really a term we use here in the US, but a place like Lightwater Valley, which I was really taken aback in a positive way, because you don't hear very much about the park. And I visited, I only had about 2 or 3 hours to visit. I went in, and the place is beautiful. It's spread out. There's a lot of open grass areas where people were just having picnics and laying out on blankets. And truly, when they say a day out, that's what a day out is. I don't think a day out is running the bulls at Cedar Point, yeah. It is a day out, but it's an exhausting day out. It's not a leisure day out. And I find that the parks in the UK and Europe, they put a heavier focus on food and beverage. You know, it's not just hot dogs and chicken fingers. And, you know, go to a place like Europa Park, for example. The food offerings, it's like you're going to a true restaurant, let's say. Whereas here, I think maybe culturally, we're fast food nation, we call it, where we just want to get our food and move to the next thing. Yeah. So in the UK, I love, specifically UK, I love the diversity, because you have facilities like Alton Towers, which obviously are massive theme parks that are built with the model similar to a Six Flags or a Cedar Fair. But it's able to exist where it does, which is such a mind-blowing, unique, and gorgeous setting, where you have the gardens, you have these stepping stones, you have these paths that would never exist in the U.S. to access the gardens. And I wonder how many guests never even see this section of the park. I spent hours down there, just my mind was blown that this is a thing that you can walk around and, you know, walking on former royal ground, essentially. But then you can go ride Nemesis, which is a absolute top-tier legacy coaster that is going to be very, very tough to beat. I also love the legacy of seaside parks in the UK. I'm a big fan. I grew up going to the boardwalks in New Jersey, the Santa Cruz Beach Boardwalk in California, the shore parks in Maryland and Delaware, and Blackpool Pleasure Beach is absolute for me. It's hard to beat that. It's hard to beat the setting, the density of rides, the way in which the park has evolved over the years, when it went from an open gate to a gated park, but it really never lost its charm, its historical heritage. And I love parks that are willing to take a risk and mix modern amusements and designs and concepts that you might see at a major gated theme park like Icon, let's say, for example. That's a ride you might expect to find at, you know, like Carowinds, Mack Rides launch coaster that was introduced last year. It's a similar ride, but here it exists in a seaside traditional park that's well over 100 years old, and it operates alongside the Big Dipper. And I love that that can happen, and it's been embraced by its public. So
obviously you've been over to the UK quite a few times. What was your sort of number one bucket list when you sort of first came over? Was it Nemesis that you were like, that's the one that I absolutely have to go to, or was it something else?
I think for a ride, for a single coaster, it was probably Nemesis or Megaphobia. But for a park, it was definitely Blackpool Pleasure Beach. Just because I grew up a half hour from Playland in New York, which is where one of the three Derby racers operates. And I also grew up, you know, going to other heritage parks here in the States, like Knoebels and Kennywood. Kennywood is almost a cousin of Blackpool, because the before Kennywood became a corporate park, the families that ran that were very close with the Thompson family. And there are a lot of, or at least back in the day, and still some elements that are very similar to the two properties. But to me, Blackpool is like if you took Maury's Piers and Wildwood and combined it with Kennywood, essentially. It has that element of seaside quirkiness, but traditional park. It doesn't try to be something it's not. And that's something, whether it's an entity or a person, it's something I respect, is that don't be fake, just be real.
I agree.
Do you think in America, do you think there's a difference in the public, or do you think it's the same as over here where, you know, there's a respect for the older rides as well, or is it all about the biggest, newest, tallest, fastest? Is there an appetite for that more in America, do you think? Because you can go so much sort of taller and faster than we can, because we have so many restrictions with our councils and stuff over here. Or do you think in America there is still a respect amongst the public for the older rides, and that people will deliberately seek them out, which I don't think does happen so much here anymore. I think within enthusiasts, you know, we do. But for the general public, I don't think they really care about a lot of the older heritage rides.
I think the very short answer is it's a market to market thing. And I also am a big believer in marketing in general. And I feel like a good marketing director can sell anything, essentially. And if a heritage ride is marketed as being iconic and something that is an integral part of a park's lineup, and the ride is well cared for so that the ride experience is repeatable, I think a heritage ride, you know, can live forever. And the Coney Island Cyclone is a great example. That's sort of in its own category, though, because I think someone in Paris, France has probably heard of Coney Island, but may not even, you know, the only amusement parks they've been to might be Parc Asterix or Disneyland Paris. The Coney Island Cyclone is like the Empire State Building. It's just something people do when they go to New York. But going back to Kennywood, has always sold itself as being America's finest traditional park in Pittsburgh. And I know, Alex, you got to visit last year with Sean on the trip. And again, very similar to Blackpool, they figured out a way to blend the newest technology while maintaining rides like the Racer, Jackrabbit, and Thunderbolt, and their carousel and their whip and other rides, and putting historic markers out at the entrance so that as guests enter the queue line, and I think Blackpool Pleasure Beach does this too at certain attractions, people can read about the history of that ride. So it's a market-to-market thing. Yes, we're definitely a country of superlatives. We love saying we're biggest, fastest, highest, largest, longest, etc. But at some point, the financial piece catches up to that. And at some point, a park is going to look at a balance sheet, let's say, and say, we can't justify going to 700 feet tall and see a return on that. So, you know, that kind of then steers you back. That's kind of, if you look at where we are, King De Ka, which incidentally today is celebrating its 15th anniversary, I believe today was its media day 15 years ago, I was reading, is still the world's tallest coaster. And I'm not a fortune teller. I can't tell you. Maybe next year a 457 foot tall ride's going to debut and prove me wrong. But I think it's going to be a while before that happens.
I agree.
Well, Saudi Arabia, we're told, isn't it? That's where the new tallest, fastest, everything is going to be at Six Flags Saudi Arabia. but we shall see.
I think, you know, the Asian market, certainly in theme parks, has been one to watch for the last maybe 5 years, certainly. Don't get me wrong, theme parks have been around a lot longer than that across Asia, of course. Synonymous ones such as the Disney parks like Tokyo Disneyland, Disney Sea. Obviously, very recently, we got Shanghai Disney, which, you know, thankfully, I can also say is now reopened. Due to everything that's going on in the world, we talked a little bit about lockdown. But one thing I do really want to talk to Mark about a little bit is how the industry is going to be affected by what is going on in the world right now. It's a very difficult time for everybody. Of course, the effects of COVID-19 have really shown in the industry. However, I feel like depending where you live, even in the States, no matter whereabouts in the States you may be listening to this, you may find that something is completely different in your town to what it is in the next town. I'd just like to get Mark's thoughts on how he thinks the industry is going to evolve after the effects of COVID, and, you know, where he sees the parks 5 years from now, etc. And, you know, is there going to be a recovery for a lot of these parks, or is it going to be very testing for them?
I think, and first off, I'm going to preface this by saying I am by no means an expert. I'm just, this is purely my opinion based on the many Zoom calls I've sat in on and industry colleagues that I've spoken with. And this is, I know we always say we're in this together, it's unprecedented times, but that's really the issue. That's why there really isn't an answer. So this is more, I appreciate this forum and we can share our opinions on it. But the US is really 50 countries, and that's one of the biggest issues that we've been faced with is states have their own rights to set their phase reopening plan, and you're all across the spectrum essentially. You have some states that are in phase one reopenings, you have some states, Tennessee, Pigeon Forge, Tennessee, their Dollywood has not reopened yet, but the attractions on the parkway, some of the go-kart tracks and other standalone, the island have reopened. And that's been good to see because there have been videos posted and people can observe how they're sanitizing rides and how they're going about their day-to-day operations. Then you have states like New York and Illinois where they have a 4 or 5 phase reopening plan. In Illinois, there's a 5 phase reopening plan, and up to phase 4, it bans any gathering of up to 50 people at one time. So needless to say, that doesn't bode well for attractions to reopen if that remains for this year. And I think a lot of parks are going to be, in the immediate for 2020, they're going to be faced with the question of, do we open this year or not? And we're going to find out more, I would say, within the next month for sure. By the end of June, we'll know. You know, some parks now have, Halloween has been a big thing in the States for a while. I know it's starting to catch on in the UK and Europe. Christmas, which I think was actually bigger in Europe than here, and now it's caught on. Hershey Park was one of the first parks to offer a Christmas program, Christmas Candy Lane, and they've been doing that for a long while, several decades now. But now you have, you know, the Busch Gardens parks and select Six Flags and Cedar Fair parks, depending on location, are offering their Holiday in the Park for Six Flags, Winterfest for Cedar Fair, and several of the Palace Entertainment properties also. So the more days you have in an operating calendar, I'm thinking the more you could justify ramping up your reopening process. Mm. It's a challenge for seasonal parks that close after Labor Day, let's say, or seasonal water parks. I think yesterday, Water World in just outside of Denver, Colorado, announced they're not opening this year. And if you guys aren't aware, Water World is one of the world's largest water parks. It's actually, it's municipally owned and operated. And that made a big statement. But Colorado is one of those states that has a very, very, you know, their phase reopening, it's kind of like, well, we can ramp up to open, but then are we going to open, June 15th? Will it be July 1? Will it be July 30th? And then the first Monday in September, we close for the season. So there's no easy way. It's a very tough, tough position the whole industry, operators and parks are in. Long-term, I do believe our industry recovers faster than almost any other industry, mainly because we provide a escapism, which we're all whether you're a park or roller coaster enthusiast or just someone that's tired of looking at your bedroom wall doing Zoom calls, I think we're all starved to get out and do something. And there's really very few things that like visiting an amusement park that you can't do at home. You know, you can't really replicate, although I have all the cute videos of people trying to replicate Pirates of the Caribbean by, you know, riding a laundry basket down their stairwell, which is cool. It's one of those things. I think provided we don't see the virus come back this fall, I think the parks will recover very quickly. Certainly by next year, I'd like to think we'll be back to some state of normalcy. The thing is more for the guests to get retrained in their, and having, in my mind, I'm calling them pandemic ambassadors, new people on staff that at least for this year are there just to remind people, hey, keep your distance, where to stand in queue lines. And I think Shanghai Disneyland did a great job with the videos that were released showing how they had cast members in the queue lines and other things. So it's sort of like a two-phase training program. The parks have to retrain their operators basically from stage one. Even if they're certified to operate every ride in the park, they have to be, in my mind, retrained to operate in today's environment with COVID. And then they have to in turn train their guests, because all too often guests visit a park and they're in escapism mode. In other words, they're, I always say that the on-off neutral switch on your brain that kind of sometimes goes to neutral where, okay, we're here to have fun. I'm not going to think about all these things, but now you have to look down at the ground and see there's a decal that says, don't stand here. Yeah. It's just another, It's an unfortunate result of the pandemic, but we will get through
lives. It's saving lives, and ultimately everybody's personal sacrifice is really benefiting the rest of the world. And I think that's something that people have really got to understand. Yes, there are risks, of course, going out of your own home. Yes, of course, there are risks visiting these theme parks, but certainly myself, Mark and Bex would all encourage you that once these parks do reopen and they deem themselves safe to reopen, that you do go out there and support your parks, you do go and visit, because actually these parks look forward to welcoming you back, and they will promise you safety if you promise them your business. And that's one thing I think is so vital, and I think if you speak to anybody in the industry worldwide right now, they will tell you the exact same thing. The industry will be waiting for you. It will be there to make your day, make your week, make your month, whatever it is, however long it is you're visiting for. You will be safe when you return to these parks. It may be different for a little while, but there will be a sense of normality once this all passes.
And I'll also add to that is that to add a layer of comfort, just know that every park has met for countless hours with their team, elected officials, and putting together contingency plans, putting together reopening guidelines. IAAPA themselves released a reopening guideline document, which is great. And then even regional, here in the States, we have regional amusement park associations, kind of like BALPA in Britain, where we're, like the New England Amusement Park Association or the Pennsylvania Amusement Park Association, they've released their own guidelines. And so the industry is supporting each other. We're all like a brotherhood, essentially. And the guests should know that a park will not open unless it is absolutely 150% safe for a guest to visit. So that's just it's a comforting thing.
With the American parks, you kind of got two tiers, haven't you? You've got like the big corporations like Six Flags who are running their parks, but then I guess you've got a lot of independent parks as well, or family-owned parks, who even more so are probably struggling at the moment because they don't have that big financial backing to sort of help them through this. Do you think that they will survive this, or do you think that there are going to be some parks who are seriously looking at not reopening their doors?
I think for the most part they'll survive. The family-owned parks are, they have smaller staffs, that are year-round. And, it's no doubt it's tough, but we have the government programs in place. I'd like to hope that everybody was able to get the benefit packages that were offered. It's one of those things where, the family-owned parks have, some of them are on third or fourth generations of operating. So there's a legacy there, and there's a pride, element of pride. I don't feel like we're, as long as everyone can kind of be back to normal by next season, just call 2020 kind of an anomaly year, I think we should be fine.
Yeah.
And will you yourself sort of, as soon as they're like, right, your local park's open, will that be you in the car kind of heading off over there?
Yeah, I'm the biggest cheerleader for our industry. It's just, It's hard to imagine, you know, I mean, we're talking specifically about our industry, but think about the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of industries that have been impacted just like this, that rely on guests showing up. This is not an industry that can operate without people. You know, we can't, no one's going to pay for a, you know, a virtual tour of a park or buy a season pass to that and just kind of ride roller coasters. It's one thing to watch YouTube videos and that kind of thing in your spare time, but we need to get reopened. And there has been some positives, though. I think I saw yesterday an industry consultant from International Ride Training shared that the state of Connecticut approved the opening of amusement parks by the, I believe it was the end of June. I don't have it in front of me, June 20th, somewhere around there. So that would include lake compounds and quasi. So I think, as you know, in general, the biggest issue was that when government heard amusement park, let's say, they're thinking, oh, you guys are, you're not opening this year. It was so, it was literally the bottom layer of the totem pole in terms of priority. But what they didn't know was that everyone was working on these very detailed and plans that are easy to execute. I think that's the most important thing, is not to sacrifice the guest experience. So these plans have all been put in place, safety number one, efficiency and guest experience number two, whether that's how to limit how many tickets you sell for a given day, you know, which is a factor of square footage, essentially. You know, I think we will get through it. It's just hard right now because we're in like the middle of that tunnel with no light behind us or in front of us. So it's hard to kind of, you know, see how we get out of this, but we will. It's just, this is a first in our generation type of event. So no one really, we have nothing to compare it to. That's the thing.
And those parks that were due to be opening sort of new rides this year, new coasters, do you think there are, from your, you know, what you've heard, are they all on standby now and they're just going to wait until 2021, even if the park reopens?
Yeah, I don't know, to be honest with you. You know, I think it'll be park to park, project to project. I think certain projects, if they do open this year, they could still be easily marketed as new next year and the public would understand. Because let's say if a park opens a new ride in late July, early August, but I'm sure there will be parks that defer their new, what were going to be new rides this year to next year, but I don't know for sure.
Well, Orion at Kings Island, it has been seen in the past week that ride has been testing. So as much as COVID has taken place and a lot of people have been furloughed from their jobs, it is important to see that these parks have still got their maintenance teams in running the rides. And Orion, of course, being the new coaster coming to Kings Island, it's good to see that coaster is testing. And, you know, hopefully it's a good sign that when that park has deemed it safe to reopen, that the coaster will be able to debut for this year, which gives some promise to the guests that are visiting that park. Because as much as I understand a lot of parks wish to push their deadlines back to next year, and certainly in the UK, any 2020 project has been delayed till 2021. It's nice to see there is still something to look forward to once the parks are safe to reopen. So, you know, I think it is, as Mark said, going to be very interesting to diverse between park to park, business to business, what is safe to do and what is the best decision moving forwards. But I mean, Mark, certainly it's been great talking to you today and, you know, having a conversation about these parks. And it's good to see that you were, just like Bex and I, very positive about the industry still, going to continue to support. And, you know, have you got any closing statements you'd like to say to the listeners of Parkcast about what you think for the future of this industry?
I mean, it's really, we're in the trenches right now, but you just know we're going to come out of this flying high. It's, you know, it's, I'm not going to compare it directly to 9/11, but when 9/11 happened, our industry was one of the quickest to rebound, essentially, you know, while others specific, you know, because we have such a large grouping of regional parks that are the staycation, quote unquote, parks. So it'll be, for me, it'll be interesting to see what the recovery is for destination areas like Orlando, you know, Southern California to a lesser extent, because they have a population base there. But I'm very hopeful that this time next year will be in a much, much more positive light. And you know, it's just one of those that, again, we've never been through this before, so it's hard to predict. We can only share thoughts, but all I know is that our industry and the professionals in it are doing everything they can to get the message across that we will reopen safely when the time is right. And that's really I think, the best thing I could say.
And Mark, thank you so much for your time and joining us on podcast today. It's been really great talking to you. Bex and I have really enjoyed every moment of it thoroughly. And, you know, we wish you all the success with the industry. And hopefully in the US, your parks will be open soon. And, you know, we'll be able to continue doing what we love to do, and that is visiting and supporting these parks across the world.
It's been great talking to you guys. Thanks for having me on.
Podcast. The UK's original theme park podcast.